This is Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. The U.S. Open Women's Golf Championship begins July 13th at Trump National Bedminster. And my guest is the director of this high-profile tournament. She also has quite a story to tell. Shannon Roulard was a walk-on golf star at Oregon University and eventually became the head coach at Oregon for 8 years. Golf has been a huge part of her life. Let's head to the USGA offices in New Jersey and meet Shannon Roulard on Sports Jam. Before we get into your entire job as director and about the tournament, I always like to find out a little bit more, the background of why people are in the positions that you are. Golf has been a big part of your life for many, many years. Let's go back. Who first introduced you to the game of golf?
Yeah, my dad introduced me to the game back when I was 15 years old. Prior to that, I was a gymnast for 10 years, and my dad said, well, you either need to stick with gymnastics, turn a college scholarship, or you need to find another sport that's going to help pay for your college education. So I didn't want to compete in gymnastics another 8 years and commit myself to that, so my dad introduced me to the game of golf when I was 15.
Are there any skills that you take over from being a young gymnast to being a young golfer?
Absolutely. You know, I feel like my competitive spirit and my desire to win certainly carried over into my golf career.
Tell us about where you grew up. And then eventually, Shannon not only picks up the game of golf, but she gets pretty darn good at it. We'll pick up, but tell us where this all started.
I was born and raised in Southern California. And, you know, to be honest, when my dad introduced me to the game, he said, Shannon, you need to learn how to hit a golf ball first. So I didn't set foot on a golf course for at least a year. So we went to the driving range, a public driving range, every single night. And I hit over 200 golf balls every single day until I was able to get the ball up in the air and hit it fairly consistently. And then in Southern California, there's a junior golf event every day of the summer. And I played in 25 junior events in less than 3 months. And I finished last or second to last in certainly the beginning of those events that I started to play in. And that's where the competitive juices and where my gymnastics time really came into play. I was tired and didn't want to get beat. I was competitive, and that's when I really started to focus in and hone my skills and work that much harder, because I didn't want these players to beat me. They were the same age as me, even though I hadn't competed as much as them. I always have had a fire in my belly and wanted to win.
There's something special about that, too, because a lot of young players, when they don't have success right away at a sport, they drop it. Mm-hmm. For you, it motivated you to be better.
It was a total motivating factor for me. It just pushed me and drove me to be better and better and to work harder than everybody else. I knew I wasn't the most talented golfer out there, but my parents instilled in me that if you work hard, you'll be successful and you'll have success. And that's what drove me to continued out to work really hard to be the best that I could be.
Not only did you have success, you were able to walk on at Oregon and play on the women's golf team. I love walk-on stories because they all have similar connections. It takes a special person. As you mentioned, you're already motivated. When did you know that you were going to be able to compete at that level when you got to Oregon?
You know, to be honest, it was a good place for me to be at Oregon. Oregon had a program back in the 70s and then had eventually dropped its program and then had recently added the women's golf program back in the late 80s. So they were in a rebuilding stage. And I felt like it was going to be a good fit for me where I was in my game. I knew I was going to go in and redshirt my freshman year to get more experience to compete and against my teammates, as well as get another year of competition under my belt playing in events over the summer. And it was the right thing for me to do. And so, again, it was the right fit for me and where I was with my game, and I just needed to continue to work hard day in and day out and each year, and hopefully the results would follow.
And they certainly did, to a point when you were finished with college, you come back to Oregon to be the women's coach for 8 years. This is quite a story. I mean, you obviously learned very well from your dad early on, because you picked up this game. Like you said, you might have been behind some of the others, but it seemed like this was a natural game for you. What was the difference for you being a coach and being a player on the university level?
You know, when I was a player, I had at some point during my playing time had aspired to be a college golf coach. I had also aspired to play professional golf, and I did that for a short period of time, but I felt like I wanted to be a college golf coach too. My dad and my mom were both instructors. My mom was an elementary school teacher. My dad was actually a youth football coach for almost 20 years, but so I felt like it was in my blood. I wanted to give back to the game. I wanted to help young women fulfill their dreams, and I felt like I had the tools to be able to help them get where they wanted to go.
And you were coming around right at the time where it was important for young women to get scholarships, to have the ability to play. Now that you see that they're getting more and more opportunities, they look to trailblazers like you and say, I'm sure a lot of young women have come up to you and said, thanks for making a difference.
I really enjoyed when I was coaching the recruiting process, being able to help these young women, if Oregon wasn't the best fit for them, to encourage them that there's a place for them to play. There's a fit for everybody at every level. And to find a place where you're going to go play. No one wants to sit home and sit on the bench and not compete. Find a place where you're going to compete. And there were some brutally honest conversations that I had with a lot of players. But there are also those that we felt were the right fit, that did come onto our team and had a major impact.
So unlike a football team, but much like a basketball team, there are only a few people that can be on the team and be stars on the team. So you really have to, you know, make the decisions when you're a coach at that level. Who's going to be your top five players, I guess?
Correct. And we had a qualifying process. We would have a lot of qualifying to give each player an opportunity to make it. You know, we had an exemption structure as well. And if individuals played really well in the past event, they could be exempt into the next one. So really trying to give everybody an opportunity to compete. I guess you can say a little bit similar to how our USGA championship structure works. You know, we have exempt players and we have qualifiers. You know, we really did mirror that in college as well.
So as the director of the U.S. Women's Open Championship, you will be among the greatest players in the world. You mentioned that you tried to be a professional golfer for a while. Just take us back to that time and the highlights and maybe some of the struggles that you saw that maybe you didn't anticipate.
It really is a tough life. I think a lot of people out there see this glamorous, life out on the road, playing week in and week out. But, you know, unlike college golf where you have your teammates to support you, you're out there by yourself. You know, you have your family there to support you, whether they're there or they're a distance away. But you really then have to work in surrounding yourself with people that support you and believe in you. You know, your coach, your family, your sports psychologist, your manager, so, and the list goes on and on of people that are going to support you and be there for you and to help you accomplish what you're going to accomplish. You know, when I played on the mini tour for a year, it was the Players West Tour up and down California and a little bit in Oregon. You know, I traveled with a teammate in our car from event to event, and we stayed in private housing. And again, it's lonely. It's a tough road. And we were playing for pennies, you know, at that time, trying to make our entry fee back to pay for the next week's entry fee. So even though it was a lot of fun, it was tough. It was really tough.
Local musicians can certainly relate to that on the buses and in their cars going from gig to gig. Even if they've already had somewhat of a following, they know exactly what you're talking about. golf not only has led you to this wonderful career, but it's also led you to the man in your life. Tell us how you met Tim and how this golf game really took on even more importance for you.
Sure. My parents had moved to South San Francisco the summer before my senior year in college, and I didn't have any place to practice. So I walked into a handful of different clubs, San Francisco Golf Club, California Golf Club, Olympic Golf Club in Lake Merced. And Olympic Golf Club, at the time, Jim Lucius was the head golf professional. And I just said, hey, I'm a college golfer. I'm here for the summer. I need a place to practice. What can I do to earn privileges? I wasn't afraid to have them say, no, we can't do anything for you, because I didn't have anything to lose. So the Olympic Club gave me privileges every single day. I just needed to come into the shop and help out with merchandising for a couple hours a day, and I could practice and play all I wanted. Pretty good gig, I would say. So I had that going for me. And then after I graduated, I came back, and Tim, my husband now, was one of the assistant pros. Previously, he was at Half Moon Bay for about 5 years and had moved over to Olympic Club. And, you know, at that time, I had turned professional. And when I was home, I was practicing out at Olympic and had the same arrangements with them. And Tim just and I just kind of started playing and practicing on the driving range, and the rest is really kind of history.
How many rounds did you have before he asked you out?
Actually, our first date was a round of golf at his previous location of employment at Half Moon Bay. I played further back than he thought I was going to play, and I think he was pretty impressed with my game at the time.
That's wonderful. And also, it wasn't like he's been Mr. Golfer all his life, too, because he was quite a hockey player before that.
He was. Tim grew up in Kennebunkport, Maine, and played hockey, gosh, ever since he could probably almost walk up until through high school. So his team at Kennebunkport High won the state championship many times while he was there, and he truly enjoys the game of ice hockey and made a major contribution to his team at that time.
And you have one son, and he's playing golf now. Tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, our son Brady is almost 14. He'll turn 14 the end of this month. And we really think he's at the point in his life now where his hand-eye coordination has gotten much, much better. And we've said, hey, we really want to play golf with you. And so I wouldn't say that we've pushed the game on him. We've just encouraged. And believe it or not, he's really taken to it. He's starting to say, hey, Mom, let's go play a few holes. Let's go play 9 holes. I want to go putt and chip. So it's encouraging to hear those things. And to be honest, and I'm not kidding, his swing is better than mine and my husband's put together. There is definitely something there that we're excited to see where that goes.
And isn't it also nice? I think the wonderful thing about golf is, you know, you hear a lot of people talk about, my dad continues to play it once a week at the age of 87. You can play this game for a long time, but it's really about going out and enjoying each other's company. Here he's had the ability to go with Mom and Dad, mm-hmm. and to improve his game. So maybe if one of you are busy or not, you know, doing something else, he has that opportunity and he's getting a great partner, which also he's learning from both of you.
Right. You know, and obviously we all know that there's more about the game than just going out and swinging and hitting a golf ball. It's those relationships. It's those memories that you're developing. It's those life skills. It's the etiquette of the game and really life lessons that are going to take him through the rest of his life that it does all of us.
And then there's Harley.
And then there's Harley. We had actually right after Tim and I got, actually not right after, about 3 years after Tim and I got married, we decided we needed a dog. So we went and purchased a golden retriever named Watson. We got him right from his mom and dad in a farm in Eugene, Oregon, where we were living at the time. And he passed away in, what was that, 2013. So we went, which as you can imagine was very difficult. We named Watson after Tom Watson, being both golfers, and the name had a ring to it. And Watson was, as we would like to say, our first baby, so to speak. So it was pretty rough when Watson passed away. We went about a year and a half without a dog, and then my husband got an itch again, and he said, we need another dog. But I told him, I said, we're not going to do the puppy thing anymore. I said, I have two conditions. I need a dog that's potty trained and a dog that's past the chewing stage. So Harley turned out to be just that. Harley was 2.5 years old, and we rescued him from an organization called Big Dog Rescue Project. And my husband saw him online, and really the rest was history. As you can imagine with any rescue, we had a few bumps in the road initially, but he's turned out to be the sweetest dog we could ever imagine.
We're speaking with Shannon Roulard, who is the director of the U.S. Women's Open Championship, and it comes to Trump National Bedminster, July 13th through the 16th, but your work has started a long time before, and I know this has been something that you've put a lot of effort into. Tell us what the director of a U.S. Open does.
Sure. Doug, you know, there's a lot that we do. You know, my counterpart, Matt Sawicki, who you had on the show a while back, is in charge of outside the ropes, so the operations of the event. My role is inside the ropes, so the conduct of the competition, the golf course setup, pace of play, rules, are the major things that I am tasked with overseeing. So as you can imagine, you know, I'm out at the golf course looking at the golf course many, many times. You know, you can't have your eyes on everything in one course walk. So it takes time, and it takes a lot of visits to go out there and figure out yardages and figure out hole locations and figure out the strategy that we want to have for the championship for each of the 4 days. Not to mention pace of play. What are we going to set that pace at, that reasonable pace for these players, and what do we expect them to complete their round in? As well as rules, how do we want the course to be marked? We do all, our rules team does all of the marking of the golf course. That's why we get there so far in advance to get started on that. We write the notice to players. And then there's things that we do for our rules officials to help them prepare once they get on site for the championship to be able to execute their role as well.
You're listening to Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. My guest is Shannon Roulard, the director of the U.S. Open Women's Golf Championship, taking place at Trump National Bedminster starting on July 13th. Let's head back to the USGA offices in New Jersey and find out more about Shannon Roulard. I saw a clip of you on YouTube, and you were called to determine who was furthest away from the pin for who's going to do the putting. You do everything when it comes to, as you mentioned, all inside the ropes. I had the opportunity, the wonderful opportunity, to play Trump and the old course that the U.S. Women's Open will be taking place. So I know what you're thinking about and these incredible holes that you're talking about. So when all is said and done, and you have the pin placements where you want, then do you go back out and do you physically play the course then to see how it works, or are you relying on others?
You know, through the planning process years in advance, I'll definitely play the course a time or two to get a feel for it. But honestly, it goes back to knowing the golf course setup. And to do that effectively, we have to know our demographic. We need, and in this case, we need to know the women's professional golfer and their skills. What are they capable of? How far does the average player hit their drive? How far do they hit each of their golf clubs? How well do they spin the ball? What is the threshold of rough that they can handle? Green speeds. We need to think about green speeds. We need to think about where we're placing the holes in relation to the slopes that may come into play. So yes, I do play, but I'm also relying on my, I guess you can say, golf administration skills and knowing the demographic that we're serving to be able to set up the golf course appropriately each day.
Those skills were learned probably when you were coaching golf, mm-hmm. because the administration skills, dealing with recruiting, dealing with courses and players, right? That was huge experience for you, wasn't it?
Absolutely. You know, and I feel like I come at it from a player's perspective. I try to put myself back in that player's mind as to what they're thinking in terms of their strategy and how they're going to play that hole. But also, too, in watching these women play. You know, we go to LPGA events and we watch them play. I watch them play on TV and continue to, in an effort to be in tune with their capabilities, is really important for me to be able to do the job to the best of my abilities.
No better place to be than on the golf course with some of the greats. So we're going to see if some of the greats can provide a tip or two. Lydia, we'll start with you. Is there something you can tell these young golfers about the approach to their game and how they should handle things?
On media day, you had a bunch of young gals, young junior players, who were obviously thrilled to be around some of the best golfers on tour. Where does the sport for women's golf, where is it right now?
The game is continuing to grow. The USGA has put in a great deal of effort and programs in place to help the game grow, not only just across the board, but for women and young girls as well. You know, the LPGA USGA Girls Golf Program has tripled in size over the last number of years. And girls more and more are coming into the game and being exposed to the game. And I think that's going to continue.
Now, does that mean we're going to have more competition from, you know, from the U.S. golfers? We know that South Korea and Japan have a lot of terrific golfers. Where does the U.S. stand right now when it comes to that? And I know a lot of those players come over to the U.S. to continue their craft.
You know, we started international qualifying back in 2014 for the Women's Open in England, South Korea, China, and Japan. And we recognize that the game is becoming more and more global, you know. And with that, we obviously jointly govern play with the RNA. And we continue to see the game grow and move in a positive fashion. Because it's become so much of a global game. You have players like Katriana Matthew and Sayuri Pak and many, many others, Ai Miyazato from Japan, who are continuing to influence other young girls from their countries to inspire them to pick up a golf club and start playing the game. And I don't think that's going to end anytime soon.
Lydia Ko, currently ranked the number one player, will be participating.
It would mean a lot, and you know, not only in golf, but in other sports, to say that you're the U.S. Open champion. You know, only a few people can say that, and you know, there, especially you know, for this U.S. Women's Open, I know there's so many legends' names that have hoisted the trophies.
She was just so nice. She just what a wonderful young woman, confident, talking to the media. I know there's a fire burning in there that we can't see because she just seems like this nice young lady who you'd meet on the course and she'd kill you down the stretch, but you can't see that necessarily inside sometimes.
You know, I do have some personal experience with Lydia. I ran the 2012 Women's Amateur when she won. That was my first championship running that event. And that's right. You knocked it right on the head there, Doug. She's very humble, yet very competitive inside, and she makes it look so easy. But yet she's down to earth, and she's friendly, and she's appreciative of those around her, those that are helping her, and the fans as well. So it's really great to see. You know, and I would say that really for all of the women out there that are playing professional golf, that are playing on the LPGA in their respective tours, they are respectful, they are appreciative, they enjoy it when fans come out and watch and play. And to be honest, they're wonderful ambassadors for the game. They inspire people to play, and they are relatable, you know, I think more relatable than potentially on the men's side because it's such a power game on the men's professional side. And I'm not downplaying the men by any stretch, but there's something about watching the women play and how they interact with players that is really neat to see.
You mentioned you have to know all this, like how far the hitters can be. What is the average length off the tee for a top women's golfer right now?
It's about 250 yards, you know, and again, that's the average. You know, you're going to find players that hit it 220, 225 off the tee, and then you're going to have players that hit it 270, 280 off the tee. So we have to keep that all into consideration when we're thinking about force carries off the tee or, you know, so on and so forth.
What's your favorite hole at Trump National, Bedminster, and why?
Gosh. You know, I have a lot of different favorites for different reasons. I really enjoy the sixth hole due to the size of its green and all of the different slope that's there. We'll be looking to utilize an alternate tee to kind of push the bunker there at the end of the fairway a little more into play with a very strategically placed hole location. But I also really like the fifth hole, too. Slight dogleg left par four as well. You know, the tee shot needs to be in the right place. Even though it's a shorter par four, it's all uphill, and the approach shot is all carry. There will be some interesting hole locations that people could expect there. But then, again, the fourth hole, par three, which has a very deep green, we will be utilizing a few alternate teeing grounds on that hole to kind of mix things up and match them up with a particular hole location, too. And then we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the final loop of holes, 16, 17, and 18. You know, the par 3 16th hole is a very shallow green, very sloping on the right side. We'll look to have an alternate tee there. And then 17 is a long par 4 where the player's going to have to think about their tee shot with the bunker on the left and the water on the right, ensuring that their tee shot is placed in the right spot. And then 18, you know, a strong finishing hole with water right in front of the green. We may tempt the players with an alternate teeing ground to make that reachable, but it should be a real exciting finish.
I must admit, when I'm a duffer, so I'm not a very good golfer, but on media day, I didn't go into the water. I was like thrilled. But boy, I tell you, I spent a lot of time in the sand. So I felt like I was at the Jersey Shore. I spent so much time there. But wonderful course to play. So now as we get closer and closer to this event, obviously the excitement builds. Has there been anything that you haven't anticipated that has come up recently that has caused a big challenge for you or maybe just got you even more excited?
My excitement is continuing to rise as I continue to think about golf course setup and where we want to be for the championship. And that all assumes that Mother Nature cooperates. But if she doesn't, then we'll certainly have alternative plans and strategies in place to make sure we're able to keep going.
And Fox will be your television partner for this event. So what's the ultimate then for you to have maybe a playoff, to have someone just play an incredible round of golf and no one can catch them? What would be the best scenario for Shannon?
You know, I'm not so sure that there's a best scenario. I think it would be exciting to see it come down to the last few holes. I wouldn't say a playoff would be ideal, but it to come to the last few holes for someone to win it, for someone to have a 10-footer, 12-footer to win the championship and to make that putt to become a Women's Open champion.
Also had the opportunity to go into the special wing of the USGA Museum that's dedicated to women's golf. And I was amazed at how long ago women got involved with this sport.
Absolutely. You know, one of the other championships that I'm in charge of overseeing is the U.S. Women's Amateur, which, along with the U.S. Amateur and the U.S. Open, are our longest standing championships. So, you know, we have been celebrating women in golf for over 100 years, and I'm not sure people really realize that. But women in golf have always been a priority to the USGA, and will continue to do so.
Some terrific names on that beautiful trophy from even the ones that were held here in New Jersey over the years. And the most one that would stand out to me would be Babe Deidreton Zaharias, considered probably the best female athlete ever, right?
Here's the one and only Babe Deidreton of the United States.
At the Los Angeles Olympics, she again broke world records in three events, winning gold medals for the javelin and hurdles, and a silver in the high jump. Eventually, Babe took up golf. She would rise to become the greatest female golfer the world would ever see.
Babe was an incredible golfer during her time, you know, but there's so many others that came soon after her that we can certainly talk about, multiple winners of whether it's the Women's Amateur or the Women's Open, that really paved the way and were trailblazers for other women in the game that came behind them.
This will change her life. No doubt about that. She played great all week. She did all the things she needed to do.
And Brittany Lang is the U.S. Women's Open champion.
Had the opportunity to talk to Brittany Lang, last year's winner, on the putting green. I asked her, you know, what's the difference? It's a different course, obviously, but she was brimming with confidence, and just that you could tell winning this event, as all of you have spoken about, is such a big deal. This is the tournament you want to win on the women's circuit.
It really is. You know, we hold our champions, all of our USGA champions, in such high regard. And the Women's Open is the one that these players want to win the most. And we're not just saying that. We're hearing that from them. And their lives change when they win a U.S. Women's Open. And they are seen in another caliber, another league of, their profession when they win an open championship. So I'm not surprised that Brittany is brimming with confidence, as she should, going into this event. So we really hope that she's able to defend her title.
Are you expecting the president to show up at his course?
That's a good question, Doug. You know, we're really not sure what to expect from the president. We're really focused on executing the championship to the best of our ability and really giving the players the best experience that we can. It's about them.
So the tournament ends, and it goes well. What's the next day like for Shannon Ruhlart?
Tearing down the office, packing up, unwinding, and starting to focus my attention towards the Women's Amateur, which will be just weeks behind.
That's wonderful. Well, we obviously wish you a great tournament coming up July 13th through July 16th at Trump National Bedminster. You think about this young gal who was 15 years old and had never hit a golf ball really at a competitive level and is now running the big event for women's golf.
Yeah, you know, Doug, it really is surreal for me. I've been fortunate enough, blessed to have played in 7 USGA championships, including the 99 US Women's Open. And when I played in the US Women's Amateur Public Links back in the summer of 1995, it was actually held here in New Jersey. And my dad and I traveled to the museum, to USGA headquarters, and walked through the museum at that time. And even then, it gave me goosebumps as we drove up the path there to the USGA, because even before I worked here, I had such high regard for the USGA. And to think that, just 20 plus years later that I'd be running the U.S. Women's Open, pinch me. It really is surreal and hard for me to believe, but I'm just very lucky and humbled to have the opportunity to run the biggest women's professional major event in the world.
Shannon Ruhlart, the director of the U.S. Women's Open Championship, Trump National Bedminster, July 13th through the 16th. You have a great story to tell, and I'm so thrilled that you told it here on Sports Jam.
Thanks so much, Doug. It really was a pleasure, and I appreciate you giving me some time.
Sports.
Sports Jam is a WBGO News production. You can check out all the podcasts by going to WBGO.org/Sports Jam. Find Sports Jam with Doug Doyle on iTunes. Until our next Sports Jam session, I'll see you at the game.